said, and then didn't look at it, six weeks from the time, then it takes my figure to be more. Please say, Tana, when he's past the two times, and over to their side, and we're going on in the dark, he's like the Mantico. When the couple do this, Taki, send away, he was up, he turned over, they go, but she made him more. This is such an interesting section. This chapter is interesting. Just today we heard about why Krishna comes. Puritanaya sadhanam vayala yala hilam syakvana bharati bharata bhutanam adamasyata dhamanam visamnyaham Pritranaya sadhunam, to deliver the sadhus, vinasya, to diskritam, to annihilate the diskritas, and to re-establish the principles of religion, sambhavami, I advent myself, I appear, millennium after millennium, yuge, yuge. And then Krishna explained the benefit of knowing about him, because he's speaking about himself. Generally, it's considered quite impolite to always speak about yourself. Yes? What do you think?
Especially in Western
countries. In India? Different? I would like to hear about this, actually. Tell me.
It's like tradition for you over there.
Yeah, so different, little bit difference in the culture. I guess one of the differences that in India the people can speak about themselves, but they're serving everyone else, serving their mother. At least even if they're materialistic, they're always serving. No.
I mean,
traditionally.
Do they include? They speak about their family.
No. I mean to say, they speak about themselves. But they're engaged in, they have a more sense of service and being part of something. Being part of the family. Westerners are much more dissociated from their families. They don't have that strong sense of belonging to family or even the country. Not the same. So Indians speak about themselves, but their actions are more serving their family or the ordinary people even. But Westerners, they don't want to speak about themselves, but they're always thinking about themselves. That's what I wanted to say. They don't want to serve anyone. Anyway, that's what I... So anyway, at least in the West, it's considered a little impolite to always speak about yourself, because it means you have an over-large estimation of your importance. And you shouldn't talk about that, at least. Everyone is thinking like that, but impolite to talk about that. But if Krishna can't have an overestimation of his importance, because he's all important, and there is nothing separate from him. So when he talks about himself, there is a great benefit for everyone. If a materialistic person talks about himself, there's no benefit at all. Maybe he'll give you something if you can recite back to him his glories. Maybe he'll favor you a little bit. But maybe you have a history test and you can remember some of the glories of the great people. What was that fellow in the Philippines thing who wrote the books?
Sierra.
Yes. And then they even named a park after him. They named the park after him.
Yeah. Streets
and parks. And he's dead and we don't know where he is, but at least he has a street in his name for five bodies ago. But when Krishna talks about himself, this is called transcendental knowledge. Divya Gyanam Vidya Prakashita. And this is why one approaches a great devotee like Prabhupada. Divya Gyan. He gives Divya Gyan, divine knowledge, and this is one of the main parts of divine knowledge, is who Krishna is and what his power is, what his position is, and what is the benefit. And that's why the devotees are so appreciative of the great souls, because they give them knowledge about Krishna. And if we know about Krishna, the ninth verse is Janma Karma Chamed Divyam. If one actually understands about Krishna, Evam Yo Viti Tattva, in truth, Tattvata, then Tattva Deham. Tattva means after giving up Deham, this body, Punat Janma Na Iti. No more birth. In Mam. Mameti Mam. You come to me, Krishna says. He attains me, Eti Mam. So that is the benefit of knowing about Krishna in truth. And Prabhupada would say, we don't have an interest in this person, in anything else other than Krishna. Because he was speaking on such a, we could say, a practical platform. Practical in the sense, for in material life, to only know about Krishna and not know how to program in Visual Basic and C++. What other? There's no programmers here. Yes, you? No, counting. In Melbourne, it's everyone.
Programmer.
Who knows how to program so many languages?
Java.
Huh?
Java.
Java, oh. But, if one knows about Krishna from the material point of view, if you only know about Krishna, it seems so impractical. But when one looks at things from the spiritual point of view, the exact opposite is there. To know about material things is completely impractical, because it's just temporary. And to know about Krishna is so practical, because Takva Deham Puna Janma Naiti Mam Eti So. So one goes to Krishna, doesn't take his birth again in the material world, because knowledge about Krishna will cause one, if one knows about Krishna, will cause one to give oneself to him, to surrender to him, because one will understand him as the absolute truth. So it's so powerful. Knowledge about Krishna is so powerful. Brings one to Krishna's eternal abode. What is Krishna's eternal abode called? Huh? Goloka Vrindavan. So what is the benefit of going to Goloka Vrindavan? What is the main benefit of going to Goloka Vrindavan? Huh?
No more birth.
Yes? Yes? Huh? Yes, what's even better than that? Is it better? Huh?
Engage in the constitution position.
Very theoretical. What is...
Always associating with Krishna.
And he's... I mean, how cool is that? You always associate with Krishna. I mean, that's what everyone is looking for. He's so attractive. He's so attractive. He's so beautiful. He's so strong. Just imagine if you had a friend who was unlimitedly powerful. Any time you were attacked, he would immediately destroy the demon, unless he wanted Balaram to do it. And he was, and you could joke with him, and you could play with him, and he had such a, he was so clever and intelligent, the way he spoke was so clever, but he wasn't proud at all, and he was all powerful but not proud, and he would share his food with you. When Mother Yasoda would give, he'd give it to the boys, and sometimes the boys would steal each other's lunch baskets, and sometimes they would cry, they would make each other cry, because that's what boys do sometimes. And he was so attractive, and he played his flute in such an incredible way that when the calves would hear the sound of Krishna's flute, and they would be sucking the milk from the mother cows. You ever see calves suck milk from mother cows, from their mothers? Did you ever see that?
Yeah.
Where?
In Darwin.
Yeah, not in Perth. And not even in KL. They go like this with their heads. You ever see that? They hit the udder with their heads to make the milk come down. You've seen that? No. They're so insistent. But when they hear the sound of Krishna's flute, they can't do anything. They're so captivated by that sound that they just are stunned, and the milk, they can't even swallow the milk, and the milk just dribbles down the sides of their mouths, and the mother cows, their ears go up just like what? Cups, yes. Cups to capture the liquid like nectarian sound. It's so amazing. So to have a friend like that, and to be able to, and to be able to be born in that village and have that feeling of camaraderie, you know, he's ours. And to see him every day, it's like, because in the village like that, and I think probably Baladeva is the only one who comes from a village, but you have a feeling like everyone is like in your family, right? Yeah, there's a feeling of camaraderie and familyship about everyone in the whole village. So that Krishna is like the member, and they see him every day. That's the benefit, the greatest benefit. Of course, no one likes death and disease and all that, so we don't mind that. But the devotees are actually so attracted to Krishna that it's not really in their mind. And they're so intensely motivated by the sweetness of tasting Krishna's pastimes that they don't even care about birth and death. This is, of course, a very advanced stage, but this is the potency of the description in Madhurya Kadambini of a devotee leaving this world. He doesn't even know that he's left, practically speaking. He's an exalted devotee. He's had darshan of Krishna, and he doesn't even know if he's in his body or not in his body. So the next verse explains you don't have to come back to this world of repeated birth and death. But it explains more than that. Vita raga, vita means free. Raga bhaya krodha. What does bhaya mean?
Yeah.
Krodha.
Yeah.
And rag.
Attachment.
So free from attachment, fear, and anger. Manmaya marupashrita. And manmaya, fully being situated in me, being absorbed in me. Bhavo jnana tapasa, because of taking the austerity of filling one's consciousness with transcendental knowledge, so purified by this transcendental knowledge, putta, by taking transcendental knowledge and purified putta madbhavam, he attains agata, he attains bhava for me, madbhavam agata, he attains transcendental knowledge of me. And he comes to me, trains transcendental love for me because of the transcendental knowledge. So this is even better, far better than liberation even from the material world, because liberation from the material world again is good, but this is even better. So this is it frees us, this transcendental knowledge of who Krishna is. It frees us from attachment. What kind of attachment? Material attachment. Attachment to things that we're going to lose anyway. And that's the peculiarity of material attachment. We're attached to things that give us pleasure, but ultimately the things in the material world that we're attached to don't give us pleasure, they give us misery, because they will be stolen from us in time by the powerful, unstoppable force of time. So attachment. So then if you realize that, interesting sequence, if you realize that everything I have and I'm attached to is going to be taken away, what's the next experience, emotion that comes?
Fear.
Yes. And then after that, when you start losing everything, you get angry. So, but the devotee isn't experiencing maya, krodha, rag on the material level. Why? Because manmaya marupasita, because he's fully absorbed in Krishna, not fully absorbed in Krishna like a drop of water gets fully absorbed in the, when you take the drop and you put it into the cup of water, it becomes absorbed and it loses itself, not in that sense, but the consciousness is fully absorbed in thoughts of Krishna. And in that thinking of Krishna, taking refuge in him, not thinking of him mamupasraya upasritaha asraya, taking full shelter of Krishna because of knowing who he is, because knowing his unlimited capacity to give shelter. He's all powerful, so he has an unlimited capacity to give shelter, but not only is he all powerful, but he's all merciful. Because someone may be all powerful but not have any tendency to help anyone and have no compassion or mercy, but Krishna has that as well. So it's required to have knowledge of that personality, Krishna, and then Puta Marbhavam, and because of this, Agata, he attains transcendental Marbhavam, and Puta Marbhavam, he attains his bhava, this love for Krishna, Agata. So here's Prabhupada's translation. Being free from attachment, fear, and anger, being fully absorbed in me and taking refuge in me, many, many persons in the past became purified by knowledge of me, and thus they all attained transcendental love for me. So what did they attain? And how? By what? By, yeah, jnana tapasa, to take this knowledge. Bahavo. Many persons, not just one person. So that's also encouraging. Being free from attachment, fear, and anger, being fully absorbed in me, because that really is supposed to be the result of this, is that our consciousness becomes absorbed in thinking of Krishna. So, yeah, this is what we want. But not like Kamsa was absorbed in thinking about Krishna. Like when Krishna, when he first entered Mathura, who was the first person he saw? I mean, not when he first entered, but he went to see the city. Because he was a village boy. And he was a village boy, first gets to the city. Oh, he wants to see all the sights. So who was the first person he saw?
When he washed the clothes.
Yeah. The washer and dyer of clothes. So he's dressed like a village boy, and everyone else is dressed like city boys. So he wanted to get some new clothes, naturally. So the washerman didn't wish to do that because he wasn't a servant of Krishna, but he was a servant of Kamsa, and he was very impolite to Krishna, and Krishna killed him. And then the second person he saw was
Maybe.
No? Who who is the next person? So, before, in between the flower person and the washerman, one other person. If you have cloth, now what are you going to do with the cloth? He was going to wear it, right? So who do you need next?
Tailor.
Yes. So then Krishna went to the tailor, and the tailor was so happy and very to be able to do this service for Krishna. And then, so Krishna had his nice clothes, and then he needed a nice flower garland. So then he saw the florist Sudama, and he brought Balaram a garland, but Krishna, he brought us the most special garland. And Krishna benedicted the maker of garlands so much. What did he asked him, he said, what do you want, I'll give you. And it was actually so wonderful what he said. One of the things he said, I want to do all good for others. So nice. But Krishna gave him everything for himself too. Everything for himself. And then he was wearing, he had his new clothes on, he had a wonderful flower garland on, and then it was time to get decorated. So he saw Kubja, and Krishna decorated him. And then, after he was decorated and he was dressed properly, because Krishna is a wonderful dresser too. He's not sloppy. He knows how to dress in just a way to attract the heart of everyone who sees him. He puts his turban on just right. Sometimes he's playing his flute, he tilts it to the side. You know, just how to look. And what color is Krishna's dhoti? And what color is his Uttariya Pitambara? Pitambara, yellow color. Sometimes, yeah. Wonderful dresser. Dresses just like an actor. Flamboyant. That's what he is. He's a flamboyant dresser. What's another word for flamboyant?
Showy,
yeah. Very extroverted, showy, colorful. And he gets everyone to look at him. So if you're talking about yourself, it's not considered polite in Western culture. Okay. If you want everyone to look at you, maybe, I guess there are people like that, a lot of people like that actually. But when everyone looks at Krishna and their consciousness becomes absorbed in Krishna, who is really benefited? When people want to look at them, it's usually because they like the attention. In fact, they need the attention because they're feeling incomplete themselves psychologically. This is a fact. But Krishna, when we look at him, he doesn't need the attention because he's the sinusoid, the center of all existence, and he's not lacking anything. But it's in our interest and benefit to look at him because we become absorbed in him. And by absorbing our consciousness in him, then knowing who he is and being absorbed in consciousness, our consciousness, then putamad bhava magata, one attains transcendental love for Krishna. So notice that being free from attachment, fear, and anger comes before transcendental love for Krishna, or also comes before, is a prerequisite to becoming, having our consciousness absorbed in thoughts of Krishna. So here's what Prabhupada says. As described above, it is very difficult for a person who is too materially affected to understand the personal nature of the Supreme Absolute Truth. What to speak of, become absorbed in thoughts of him, because if one is absorbed in material affectations, all his desires are on the material level, then you can't have your mind in two places at once. If you're thinking about material things, how are you going to be thinking about Krishna? Well, so, but Prabhupada speaks even in a more basic way, that it's very difficult to understand the personal nature of the Absolute Truth if you're materially affected. Why? Because then when you hear about Krishna being a person, the Supreme Absolute Truth being a person, and your whole conceptual framework is matter, then you can't accept it, and then you become an impersonalist. Because you think that the Absolute Truth, if he had a personality, that would limit him. Because your whole concept of everything in existence is material. So the material conception of God is impersonal. The materialist's conception of the Absolute Truth is impersonal because it's the because it's spiritual, so it's the non-existence of anything material, so it's based on the concept of non-existence. But the spiritual realm is more than non-materialism. So if one has his conceptions of existence only on matter, it's very difficult for him to accept the personal nature of the Supreme Absolute Truth. Generally, people who are attached to the bodily conception of life are so absorbed in materialism that it is almost impossible for them to understand how the Supreme can be a person. Such materialists cannot even imagine that there is a transcendental body which is imperishable, full of knowledge, and eternally blissful. Because it's beyond our experience. And a materialistic person, his experience is only of matter, and he's thinking of his body, and he sees that bodies are limited, and that they grow old, and they die, and they think that talking about an eternal spiritual body that's unlimitedly beautiful, that's unlimitedly powerful, that's eternally so, and never becomes old, they think it's just fanciful, just someone's imagination. Or what Prabhupada would say, they think it's mythology. In the material conception concept, the body is perishable, full of ignorance, and completely miserable. People don't usually think of their bodies like that, but really it is so. The body is perishable, everyone accepts that. Prabhupada speaks so straight. It's full of ignorance. Do people think of their bodies full of ignorance? No. But is the body full of ignorance? We have no idea what's going on, actually. We're ignorant of our body, and we're not conscious of it. And so much of the yoga practice, actually, the Ashtanga yoga practice on the asana level, is to remove the ignorance and to be able to place your body, manipulate, to bring your consciousness in your body. And it's so exacting how it's supposed to be done, so you become conscious of every part of your body instead of unconscious. So it's a mechanical way for materialistic people to bring their consciousness at least to their body, and then from when their consciousness is in their body, then they can move to withdraw their consciousness from the outside world and through breath. And because we do things unconsciously with our body and to our body. So yoga is trying to bring conscious control over your body. And if you've ever seen a really expert practitioner of Ashtanga yoga, the things that they can do with their bodies, it's astounding. I mean, it's shocking, actually, how much control they have over their bodies. Did anyone ever see anything like that?
Yes.
Huh?
The Mother Ganga DVD, they have shown. Mother Ganga DVD, they have shown a person doing Ashtanga yoga.
And was it amazing?
Oh, it's beyond our...
Yeah, I've never seen it. It's And it comes from gaining complete control over your body, not of course complete control, but almost even the internal movings of your body, from the breath to the heartbeat and things like that. You're able to manipulate these things by consciousness. In that sense, you're removing the ignorance from your body. But people in general have the body is full of ignorance simply, and especially when they place their identification, their self-identification on the body, that's ignorance, because even the statement shows its ignorance, because they place their identification of the self on the body. So there's a difference between themselves and their body, but they take the identification. And we all do that completely unconsciously. We say, my body. So we know that the body belongs to us. It isn't us. Just like we say, my chadar, or my house, or my car, or my son, or my daughter. There's a difference between me and the object that's mine. But I am imposing the sense of self on that other object that isn't actually myself. So we say that is my body. And in ignorance, sometimes we say even my soul. But who's this one who's saying my soul? It's the soul, unconscious. That he's talking about himself, not about something that's his. So much ignorance is there. So in the due to the material concept, the body is perishable, full of ignorance. And here's the other one that people don't accept. It's completely miserable. Now, if you talk about this too much, you're not going to have any friends. It's completely miserable. Do you believe that? No, we think of it in a different way. If this is the source of my pleasure, and what would I do without it? And my best friend. But actually, it's completely miserable. Because I can think of two things, three things, four. It's always giving. It gives trouble, especially as you get older. One thing after the next, and then it gives you pain, and then it dies. Okay, everyone knows that one. But also, it's miserable because if you compare the pleasure you can get from, think of any part of your body. The one I usually think of when I say this one is my toe, the big toe or little toe. Now think of how much pleasure you can get from that toe, how much pleasure I can get. And then think of how much misery I can get from it. I mean, if I take a hammer and smash it, there's so much unlimited misery, but only a little bit of pleasure. So then one could say, okay, I can accept that every part of my body and my body has much more misery than pleasure. But Prabhupada didn't say much more. He said it's full of ignorance and it has more, he didn't say, and has more misery than pleasure capacity. He said it's complete misery. So how are we going to, I think, maybe Prabhupada's exaggerating, just trying to make a point, but actually it's complete misery because the pleasure is also a source of misery. Because we become attached to it. Everything that gives us pleasure, we become attached to. Even pleasure in the mode of goodness, which is essentially non-attached, causes attachment, the mode of passion, because it gives us pleasure. So it's true. Therefore, because of the material concept, people in general keep the same bodily idea in mind when they are informed of the personal form of the Lord. For such materialistic men, the form of a gigantic material manifestation is supreme. That's all that they can think of. And you can see this in the whole New Age type of people. They see the universe as a, because they're somewhat spiritual, but total. So they see the material. Tora means siu. Because they see the universe as an organism. That's how they see it. And that's mentioned in a later chapter as one of the realizations about God, to see the universe as an organism, as one organism, and you're a part of that organism. So this is the great spiritual realization of the spiritual type of New Age type of people, that everything, we're part of this great universal organism. So it's materialistic. It's just taking the material concept and expanding it to the limit of their material ability. But we talk about something that's beyond the material capacity to understand. We talk about Goloka Vrindavan and that supreme Lord is eternal, and there's a realm, a completely different realm, that's also eternal and full of bliss and knowledge. And yet, there is a person there, and he is the center. And that there's transcendental cows there. And transcendental trees. And transcendental... What else? Huh? Touchstones and what else?
Swans
and...
Monkeys,
and also that Supreme Person has girlfriends. Try to put that into your material mind, and it just doesn't fit. And even there are transcendental demigods there, devatas. Did you know that? There are devatas there, but they're not the devatas of this world. They're transcendental, completely eternal. And everyone has a relationship with Krishna. So this is so how can the material mind and the mind of a materialist comprehend this? At some point the material mind will say no, because this has nothing to do with the material mind, and the material mind only deals with its experiences. So for such materialistic men, the form of the gigantic material manifestation is supreme. Consequently, they consider the supreme to be impersonal. And because they are too materially absorbed, the conception of retaining the personality of the liberation from matter frightens them. And when they are informed that spiritual life is also individual and personal, they become afraid of becoming persons again. And so they naturally prefer a kind of merging into the impersonal void. So impersonal void. So this combines the concept of the Buddhists and the Advaita Brahmavadis. Impersonal void. Because really impersonalism and voidism are basically the same. There's really no difference. Basically, Sripad Shankaracharya incorporated the Buddhist conception, but placed it within a Vedic framework. Yes. Generally, the impersonalists or the materialists, the people, compare the living entities to the bubbles of the ocean, which merge into the ocean. That is the highest perfection of spiritual existence attainable without individual personality. This is a kind of fearful stage of life devoid of perfect knowledge of spiritual existence. Furthermore, there are many persons who cannot understand spiritual existence at all. being embarrassed by so many theories and by contradictions of various type of philosophical speculation, to become disgusted or angry and foolishly conclude there is no supreme cause and that everything is ultimately void. Such people are in a diseased condition of life. Some people are too materially attached and therefore do not give attention to spiritual life. And some of them want to merge into the supreme spiritual cause. And some of them disbelieve in everything, being angry at all sorts of spiritual speculations out of hopelessness. And the last class of men take to the shelter of some kind of intoxication. Mm-hmm. And their affective hallucinations are sometimes accepted as spiritual visions. And one has to get rid of all three stages of attachment to the material world. Negligence of spiritual life, fear of a spiritual personal identity, and the conception of void that arises from frustration in life. Because the teaching of the Buddha, as commonly understood as Buddhism, isn't actually a philosophical teaching, it's just simply a psychological teaching to avoid misery. And they say material life, that's the first principle. Material life means suffering, it's misery. And therefore, there's the process of avoiding that by ceasing to exist. It's like if you get a parking ticket or something and you don't want to pay it. So you can kill yourself and then you don't have to pay it. But that's not really the best solution. So similarly, the sufferings of material life, if you don't exist anymore, then you don't have to suffer due to the frustrations. But that's not the best solution. How to do this, to get free from these three stages, negligence of spiritual life, fear of personal identity, and the conception of void that arises from frustration. To get free from these three stages of material concept of life, they're all material. One is anti-material, but based on matter, two of them, and one of them is attached to matter. So to do that, to get free, one has to take complete shelter of the Lord, guided by the bona fide spiritual master, and follow the disciplines and regulative principles of spiritual life. And the last stage of the devotion life is called bhava, or transcendental love of Godhead. According to Bhakti Samhita Sindhu, the science of devotional service, and then the Odoshradha verse. So, okay, there's more to Prabhupada's purport, but I wanted to keep this more an overview and move on. So, there's different concepts that are mentioned. So, one person gets void, one person who gets material attachment, one person gets impersonal liberation, and the devotees get love for Krishna, madhavam. So, what should people get? What is the principle? Because there are people who actually don't want to develop love for you. So what's the principle that governs what they get? Krishna has described the fact that if someone is free from attachment, fear and anger and they become absorbed in him, they develop love for him and come to him. But what happens if someone doesn't want to come to him? Do you have to? Krishna's answer is in the next verse, Yeya tam mam prapadyante tamstataiva bhajamyaham mamavart manavartante manusya parta salvisa. As all surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. Everyone follows my path in all respects, O son of Prita. I give them exactly what they want, neither more nor less. So if one wants to merge into Brahman, one gets to merge in Brahman. If one wants material things, one gets material things. If one wants to go to Krishna, one goes to Krishna. And it is Krishna who's awarding all these different results.
to all these different people, to everyone. Samoham Savabhutesu Name Vesos Tinapriya. It's giving people what they want, a combination of what they want on the level of that they deserve it. Because if people only got what they want and not mitigated by what they deserve, then there would be very few poor people. Everyone would be millionaires and billionaires because that's what people want. But it's also according to what one deserves. But it is Krishna who's awarding results to people. We'll read some of Prabhupada's purport here. Everyone is searching for Krishna in the different aspects of his manifestations. Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is partially realized in his impersonal Brahma Jyoti effulgence and as the all-pervading Supersoul dwelling within everything, including the particles of atoms. But Krishna is fully realized only by his pure devotees. Consequently, Krishna is the object of everyone's realization, and thus everyone and everyone is satisfied according to one's desire to have him. Even if people want matter, if they want that as their result, something on the material level, that's also Krishna, because nothing exists, Mama. Yad vibhuti mat sattvam, nothing exists outside of Krishna. It's all resting upon him. Krishna is the object of everyone's realization, and thus anyone and everyone is satisfied according to one's desire to have him. In the transcendental world also, Krishna reciprocates with his pure devotees in the transcendental attitude, just as the devotee wants him. One devotee may want Krishna as supreme master, another as his personal friend, another as his son, and still another as his lover. Krishna rewards all the devotees equally, according to their different intensities of love for him. In the material world, the same reciprocations of feelings are there, and they are equally exchanged by the Lord with the different types of worshippers. The pure devotees, both here and in the transcendental abode, associate with him in person and are able to render personal service to the Lord and thus derive transcendental bliss in his loving service. Did you hear something really interesting in that? Let me read it again. The pure devotees, both here and in the transcendental abode, both associate with him in person and are able to render personal service to the Lord and thus derive transcendental bliss in his loving service. So that's why the devotee doesn't care even about liberation or even going back to Godhead on a particular level. Is because here and there it's the same thing, serving Krishna and reciprocating with him. So that's quite wonderful, astounding. And as for those who are impersonalists and want to commit spiritual suicide by annihilating the individual existence of the living entity, Krishna helps them also by absorbing them into his effulgence. And actually there's two kinds of impersonalists, say three kinds of impersonalists. This is described in other purports. But there are three kinds of impersonalists. One impersonalist thinks that the Lord's spiritual form doesn't exist. And what are they called?
Mayavadis.
And for them,
what is the result? Krishna explains. Huh? Yeah, they don't get mogasya moga kamano moga jnana vichetasa asurim rakshishim saiva something mohanim shrita. They're bewildered and they don't get liberation. They only vimukti maninas, they're liberated only in their mind. So that's one kind. But there's another kind of impersonalists who accept the form of the Lord, but they prefer impersonal. So they can actually go to Brahman. And then there's another kind of impersonalists who are yogis, who accept the body of the Lord, and they don't want to merge into his effulgence, they want to merge directly into his body. These are the followers. I was just reading this, can't remember exactly where, maybe it's Chaitanya Charitamrita, but those are considered the worst, because they accept the body of the Lord in that way, but they want to still become, they don't, it's like anything but serve. Anything but serve. The anti-serving mood is so strong. They can be so exalted, free from material consciousness, but still, anything but serve. I'm God, you're God. Confused. They say that we're all God.
Yeah, God. Everyone is God.
Everyone is God. They, usually they're that one, the first one.
Okay.
Yeah. The true impersonalists are rare, and true yogis are rare. But Mayavadis, everyone. We're all God. What do you think? Except for Krishna, right?
You know Krishna's gone there, objection to that.
Yeah.
Anyone else is gone. I'm God, you're God, everyone's God. You say Krishna's gone, no. that's a true my value.
Did someone tell you that recently? That he was. No, Hammer, did someone tell you recently that you're God, I'm God?
Customers, you know, the Mayavad.
Do they hope they still pay? Even though they pay anyway?
This
double to give God tax. Do they ever question why they have to pay if they're God and you're God and we're all one? Why don't you pay them then for the meeting? Yeah, for business, practical. Yeah. What a funny philosophy. I mean, funny in a peculiar way, isn't it?
That's the pet in parking.
Yeah. or why do they even have cars if they're God? Or their petrol for their cars? Or Redo? But why can't they just. Why do they have to do anything? Why don't they just use their Icha Shakti, their desiring potency, and it all happens? I mean, what?
Well, the problem is that your God is wrong, and you also have a desiring potency for competition. God points.
That's a new word. I never heard that one before. Get your God points. Is that like. Is that like frequent flyer points? Oh, what a peculiar philosophy, isn't it? But it's so popular. It's so obvious that it's not true, right? Yeah?
Even some new age people.
Almost all of them ultimately say that. Oh, God.
Say that, just be free, you know, don't have any attachment, you don't need anything, you know, just, you are God, you know, you don't need teacher and all that. Friends will come here.
But they but make sure they pay, you know, when they come to the restaurant. We don't need anything. But how come they come to the restaurant? But if it, you
because in my heart of hearts, I want to be God. I don't have to say it, but that's what I want. And then there's all these other people. So then the solution is that we're all gone. Then I can be God.
Either that or you could say, I'm the only God. And you don't even exist. Well, this is, well, basically it comes to the same point.
Yeah.
Anyway, peculiar philosophy. But it's Krishna who is awarding everyone according to what they want as the super soul. Samaham sarvabhuteshu. Name dvesrishtinapriya. For those who are fruitive workers, the Lord awards the desired results of their prescribed duties, as did Jagesha. Those who are yogis seeking mystical powers are awarded such powers. In other words, everyone is dependent for success upon his mercy alone, and all kinds of spiritual processes are at different degrees of success on the same path. Unless, therefore, one comes to the highest perfection in Krishna consciousness, all attempts remain imperfect. As stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Kama Sava Kamava, Moksha Kama Garadi, Tevena Bhakti Yogini, Zeta Purushaparam. Whether one is without desires, which is the condition of the devotees, or is desirous of all fruit of results, or is after liberation, one should with all effort try to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead for complete perfection, culminating in Krishna consciousness. Yeah, there's a whole group of Advaitavadis who say that there is no need for a teacher because there are no teachings. Because there are no teachings. It's just realizing what is already there. No teacher, no teachings.
But they write books, right?
Huh?
But they write books.
And they also watch cricket, too. I mean, after all, when India plays Pakistan, what else?
Once, this is maybe
a
remember that there was in Prabhupada's class, also one person said, I'm God, I'm God. Also, he was shouting, he's God. One of the class.
In 1967 in San Francisco, but that was the one where the mentioned about the taking intoxication and the resulting hallucination. They accept the spiritual.
Mm-hmm. Was that problem in the philosophy or mind that people come in contact with Krishna consciousness all day, and they just take it all on God, on the mind.
Well, because they can't get to the point of wishing to serve and surrendering.
Mm.
Because that's
the last year of mind?
Impersonalism, because it's the impersonal realization to merge is the last snare of Maya. Because you're free from material desires, taking it on if they're real Advaitavadis, not the New Age people, and not the. But if they're completely practicing Jnana Yoga, completely renounced from matter, don't want to engage in any material activity, so they don't perform any karma at all, which was discussed in the last chapter. But yet, because they can't surrender, they want to become everything instead of serving everything. So they're snared by Maya again, even though they have no material attachment. So Therefore Krishna says Brahma-bhuta prasanatmana sochati nakamchati samasadeshu bhuteshu madbhaktim. What's the last part?
Madbhaktiparam.
Madbhaktim, so still. Yeah. Any other questions? Do you ever meet anyone who says they are God? Did you ever meet anyone who said they were God? You did?
My workmate. I mean, she's sort of Jainism, which my parents are from.
Yeah.
I don't know, she's vegetarian and she just thinks that we're all gods and that's what he says over there. And Krishna is just like us and he came, he has to go to hell and he has to come back and his next birth will take him Jain and he will be supposed and get liberated. I was trying to tell her that it's not there, we can't get any. I gave her some books or Gita and
some misunderstanding.
Jainism a long time ago, and you know, like you can get liberated, and Jainism Jesus, you get liberated, and that's it. There's no activity.
So. Yeah. So many philosophies. Jainism actually started at the same time, approximately the same time as Buddhism, and it was a rebellion against the improprieties of the Vedic culture. People weren't practicing properly, and especially in the animal sacrifice, so they're non-violent, and the eating is very, and Buddhism too, Ahimsa Paramo Dharma. Because they were both reactions against the bad things of the Vedic culture. But then what happened is that the people in the Vedic culture, they started losing their followers. So then they adopted it. They adopted the Vedic system and they stopped very much killing the animals and things like that. And then the people started coming back. And then the Buddhists and the Jains started losing followers. So they incorporated more Hindu things. So they started worshipping deities and all the things that...
Jainism anyway, at the moment, is quite consistent. Some Jains use temples in India, which have a lot of money, but they say you can't use this money except for to build temples.
Yeah.
Billions of dollars, you know. Some say you should.
And some wear clothes, and some don't wear clothes.
Yeah.
Dig jump.
It's all
And they wear the masks. You've seen them because they don't want to be violent. But how non-violent and renounced is it possible to be? They have to still eat. They have
potatoes or anything to grow under the ground.
Yeah.
So that's like killing the whole plant instead of just chopping parts of the plant.
And they're renounced.
So the woman shaves the head. Very. Very. I feel sorry for them. My friend's sister, she accepted that path. You know, very young, just last year she accepted. And I feel sorry for that young. But she was still unmarried, shaved head, wear only white body, stay in the ashram.
for the whole life. Thank you.
But there's no kirtan, none of the sweetness of the holy names.
No, but for instance, some people said that he's not teaching all that long, do you read your find your own way out?
Well, that sounds like a teaching. Yes, to say that there is no teaching is also a teaching.
No interest in me.
Huh?
No interest in me.
No.
No. After the ship, after the Shabdev explained the sun, then there is also Jainism where.
Except for Shabdev and Arhat.
So that Jainism is different than Christianism?
No, that's the same. The Shabdev is known to be the first. And supposed to be 24 after that, being Mahavir.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like, it seems like in the time teaching the loss of so just, kept a little.
So that is small sect, basically. Well, Buddhism on the other hand became much bigger than it, but Buddhism is also quite interesting that they talk about, they don't have no idea what Buddhism is actually, because after 250 years after Buddha left, there was 25 or 100 or something different sects of Buddhism. And some of them believed that there was no soul, some of them believed that there was a soul. And they happened to find some of the books of the ones who didn't believe there's a soul. But it was like 250 years after the Buddha, and had branched out so many different directions by that time. And that's what they accepted, Buddhism. And then there was so much Hindu. Incorporated so many of the Hindu practices that then this fellow came, I can't remember his name, Nagarjuna maybe. And then he cleaned up, got rid of all the Hindus and made it completely voidist. But that was,
Who did that?
I can't remember. It was either maybe maybe it was Nagarjuna. Around 2,000 years ago, he set up what is contemporary now thought of as Buddhism by getting rid of so much of the Hindu part of it. But if you go to Korea, for example, they worship big, they bow down to Buddha statues. They offer their bow down like this. So it's very peculiar. But originally, Buddhist teachings weren't philosophical. They weren't like that. And his lectures on the non-existence of the soul, which are known, don't really talk about the soul non-existing. So I can show it to you. It's known. It's Buddha's second sermon on the non-existence of the soul, but it doesn't specifically say that there's no soul. So it's just a later interpolation. Because he talked about removing the material tabernacle, basically, and removing suffering by doing that. He said attachment is the cause of suffering, so remove the attachment, and the middle path. And then they put in this whole other idea later on. Then there's Mahayana Buddhism about the bodhisattva, and the greatest thing is the person who, out of compassion, comes, gives up his own salvation and merging, and going into the void to help others, and he stays back. And that's the kind of thing that the Tibetan Buddhists from Dalai Lama, that kind of a thing. But it's just all. And then you go to China, and you go to the Buddhist temples in China, and they're full of all the demigods. And also in Thailand, they have all the demigods are there, but all with like faces of the Buddha. And there's, you know, so many Buddhas. And there's one who's, it's so amazing, there's Yamaraj, and you know, they're all the ones. There's the Buddha who gives, you know, who's the god of wealth. There's a Buddha who's like Indra. There's a Buddha, this kind of Buddha and that kind of Buddha. And they've just incorporated the whole Hindu philosophy in it. Because that's what people naturally want. They want persons. They want to deal with persons. They don't want to deal with nothing. It doesn't work. Because they're persons. We want to deal with persons.
What about people or devotees who actually want to have the form of Krishna? Some desire to have this form. Just one
similar form.
Similar form like that.
Sarupya.
Sarupya
Mukti.
So what can they, so what, how do we categorize them? Having the form of Krishna, then
you'd
be like,
yeah. No. If the mood is predominated by service, then it's a valid form of liberation. That's acceptable for Vaishnavas. But it's not in Vrindavan so much. But Sri Uddhava had a very similar form to Krishna. But not in Vrindavan, the devotees don't want things like that. That's the Vaikuntha liberation. To live on the same planet as Krishna, to have opulence is similar to his. Same form. But it's all for service, because they have love for Krishna, they have a kind of prema.
In Buddhism, they say that everyone is a Buddha. In one sense, it's impersonal, they say. But I'm not sure whether they're thinking like they say that we have the same quality of God.
Buddhism is very confused, very confused philosophy. First of all, one of the reasons it's confusing because they believe in reincarnation and transmigration, but there's no soul. There's no soul. So something transmigrates, something. And the idea is to stop transmigration, to stop the existence of the thing that's transmigrating, but it doesn't, isn't you. Huh? But what is it grouped around? How does it group around nothing? What causes it to group around nothing? And then the other point is it's so compassionate, but it's all, everything is illusion. So how could you be compassionate about an illusion? Stop an illusory suffering. And to get back their homeland. But it's all illusion. It doesn't exist. Nothing exists in Buddhism, according to this kind of Buddhism. Nothing is transmigrating.
There's a place at the end called Nirvana.
A place?
A place called Nirvana. At the end
I thought it was a band.
Before the band, there was a...
Before the band?
The band was only there around in the 90s.
I don't know.
Long time ago, there was a part of Buddhist philosophy.
But Chris also mentions Nirvana.
Yeah, you see in Nirvana, in Buddha land.
Buddha land. Is that like Disneyland? But it's all illusion. It just doesn't make any sense. There's no existence of anything. It's all void, and you can't even talk about it. Because the concepts that you say, like the like there's a concept of void. But that doesn't exist. The void doesn't exist either in Buddhism.
But I discussed with a monk before. I said, "Is what is in the void? You know, there's something in the void. You know, you see, it's not just void. You know, within the void there is something." I said, why is void? Is nothing? You know,
within the void there's something.
So you think it's a void, but within the void there is something is there. So it's
confused.
Very confusing.
Especially for them.
That fourfold truth is that nothing, this Buddhist monk, the material world exists. He says, no, we can't say the material world exists. Nothing is material, so the material world doesn't exist. He says, no, we can't say the material world doesn't exist. So, well, can we say the material world both exists and doesn't exist? He says, no, we can't say the material world both exists and doesn't exist. When we say the material world doesn't exist and doesn't not exist, says no, we can't say the material world doesn't exist and doesn't not exist. The Buddha is free from all theories. Once you've got your head around that, you can understand the philosophy. It's free from all theories. It's void.
And that's because the concept of void is void of the concept of void also. Yeah, it's not very much you could do. But there's this one conversation I heard with Prabhupada with a Buddhist monk. And he's the only person that I heard when I was listening to all the conversations that Prabhupada didn't preach to. He let him talk the whole time almost and was sort of friendly with him, but he didn't preach to him because it's offensive to preach to the faithless. That was my conclusion. But it was really unique in all the different conversations. Sometimes when Prabhupada spoke to people, it was very heavy and demanding, and he like picked a quarrel with them, you know, to start conversation to prove something and that their philosophy was wrong, but this Buddhist wouldn't talk to him. I mean, he talked to him and was gentle and polite with him, but he wouldn't preach to him. Did you hear that?
No, but I saw Prabhupada at a Catholic monastery, and he did, and he gave a lecture for them, a lecture group. But when he was with the father and the child, he just chatted with him.
But right. But with this man,
he didn't absolute him.
He didn't what?
He didn't absolute him.
Absolute him?
Give him the absolute.
Yeah. Well, my thought was that. Yeah, the Prabhupada didn't preach to the faithless. And when Nityananda Prabhu, he saw some Buddhists when he was touring, Chaitanya Bhagavat describes, and he asked them some questions, and they couldn't answer his questions, so he beat them and chased them all away. He just didn't care. He got angry at them and beat them all up.
Who is this?
Nityananda Prabhu.
It seems the preaching is most difficult in Buddhist countries of anywhere, Japan and Bhutan and Thailand.
Well, you haven't tried Saudi Arabia yet. Sounds like.
The Muslim countries, the Lord God is in Iran.
But Saudi Arabia, you're not allowed to, in so many of these countries, you're not allowed to bring in a book, you're not allowed to bring in a picture. You can't bring anything in the country.
But you've got so much freedom, so you can go into Thailand and do whatever you want.
Yeah. To be successful. With it, But in Burma, maybe it's to the Hindus more. But in Burma, the preaching is very big. very big, but it may be to the Hindus now. Very successful, but it may be to the Hindus.
Yeah, but in Thailand, they're probably...
Yeah, but in Burma, I'm not sure, but it's very successful.
It's nearer to India, so I
guess. Yeah. It's right next to Bangladesh. It's also difficult to preach to Jains. Very difficult. You know, they're very favorable, they're very pious, but very rarely.
Starting Krishna.
Huh? Starting Krishna comes. Oh, so this one over here, he said it's in Melbourne, what's that devotee's name? Vijay. Huh? In Chaitanya and Vijay, there's another one too. Because they're so much more pious. Actually, because they've been vegetarian their whole life too. But to have that impersonalism is such a disease, it's hard to remove it. It's easier to be a materialist. Better to be a materialist than an impersonalist. Yeah, yes, problem.
I felt I had been a Buddhist before in my past life. I have also taken a path in Buddhism, and I suppose I've gone through a different path in different lifetimes also.
Yeah.
But I have a friend who actually had we did meditation together, and he had actually, in his consciousness, he actually saw a few, because we were monks, Buddhist monks, so I was just thinking. I also had a strong thing.
Let it be finished.
You must have come across a devotee when you were a Buddhist monk.
It was probably Prasadam. Because he's Prasadam distributor.
Oh, yeah.
He knows the value of Prasadam. Okay, good night. Hare Krishna.